Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Linux and Open Source News Show. I'm your host, Nick, and this is a podcast where we discuss everything that happened in the Linux, open source, privacy, and open web space for the last week. So, this time, we have a bunch of stuff. We have Redis moving to a source available license instead of being pure open source, and thus gets forked immediately. We have the release of the Fedora 40 beta and an interesting blog post about the future of the Linux desktop. We have some changes for Canonical and Ubuntu, especially them addressing the scam problem on the Snap Store. We have some improvements coming to FlatHub and some better adoption as well. And we have the usual privacy problems with the Mozilla Monitor Plus service, with the US ordering Google to handle data over YouTube viewers. And we have some more EU investigations after the Digital Markets Act, plus some interesting gaming news, notably with a new NVIDIA driver to replace Nuvo for recent GPUs, and some bad news about EA's anti-cheat. So, as always, if you want to dive deeper into any of these topics, I left all the links I used to write this show in the show notes. And if you want to support the show and keep it going, there are plenty of links in the show notes as well. And if you become a Patreon member, you'll actually get a daily version of this show, so you can get up to date every day from Monday to Friday. So now let's get started. So you might have heard about Redis moving from their BSD 3 clause license, which is an open source free software license, to a source available only license. They moved to a dual licensing scheme, one using the, I think it's SSPL license, and another one written specifically for Redis. And thus it has ended its open source slash free software status, at least as defined by the Open Source Initiative, which is generally recognized as the entity that will say if something is truly open source or not, because the new licenses that they adopted place restrictions on what you can do with Redis's source code. So the Linux Foundation, seeing that, they decided to provide an alternative in the form of a fork called Valky. It has the exact same purposes as Redis. It is an in-memory object storage solution. It will be used for caching and any other database and object-related use cases. Valky is based on the last version of Redis that was licensed under the BSD 3 clause license, because the new licenses only apply to new versions of Redis. They cannot make that retroactive to older versions. The fork is backed by AWS, by Google Cloud, by Oracle, by Ericsson, and more. And it will live under the umbrella of the Linux Foundation to provide an open source alternative to Redis. And you'll see why this is backed by a bunch of cloud providers in a moment. And apparently, a lot of the contributors to Redis moved to working on Valky instead after the licensing change. Redis said that moving to this source available license was basically to fight big cloud providers, such as the ones backing the Valky fork, because these providers shipped Redis to their users without going through the normal commercial licensing terms of Redis. They basically took the source code, repackaged it, and provided it to all their clients without paying anything to Redis. With these new licenses, Redis would actually force these providers to pay them to deliver Redis, because they would have to agree to some licensing terms. So basically, the move is to make sure that these big cloud providers that provide Redis as part of their cloud platforms pay for shipping Redis, which seems fair at a glance. Microsoft, for example, already has commercial agreements with Redis, and they pay them. I don't know if they pay them per install or a general fee, but they pay them. AWS or Google do not. So it looks fair. The problem is, this license change also introduces limitations on how general people can modify and redistribute the source code. I am not a legal expert or an open source license expert, so absolutely feel free to correct me in the comments if what I'm saying here is inaccurate. But from what I understand, those licenses seem to mean that you cannot fork the project and redistribute that fork. You can only use that fork for your own purposes. The license Redis moved to allows you to redistribute modified version of Redis as part of a service, like, for example, if you provide a giant cloud platform. But some terms in that license also say that you have to redistribute all the source code for your entire service under that same SSPL license. And this seems fundamentally incompatible with other open source licenses from other projects that you will obviously have on your cloud platform, like the GPL. In practice, for example, if you decided to ship Redis or a fork of Redis as part of your cloud offering, let's say, for example, AWS decides to not pay Redis, just grab the source code and redistribute a fork of that, they would still have to redistribute that source code under the SSPL, that's not a problem, but they would also have to redistribute all the source code that they ship for AWS under the SSPL, and that's just not possible because parts of AWS are definitely made with GPL projects, and the GPL means that you have to redistribute your source code under the GPL. You cannot redistribute that source code under the two licenses because they're incompatible. Meaning that in practice, you just cannot use that clause of Redis's license, and so you're just not really allowed to redistribute a fork of Redis. Now, this is how I understand things. I am not a license expert, so feel free to correct me. But to me, this change seems like the usual, let's use false contributors to improve our tool and make it good and make it big and make it well known, and then we'll do a 180 and monetize the hell out of this, and we'll just throw open source licenses away. Whether that is the right interpretation, I will leave it up to you. But it is always good to have a fork of that seems well supported and has the backing of big players, in case this licensing change is as bad as I think it looks. Other companies did the same kind of move recently. Mongo for MongoDB, Elastic for Elasticsearch, HashiCorp, and of course there was the Red Hat limitations. They didn't change the license of the source code, but they added additional terms, meaning that you just could not redistribute Red Hat source code if you wanted to keep working with Red Hat as a customer. So in all cases, it had a negative impact on open source software and the entire ecosystem in general. So I will assume it is the same here with Redis, but do let me know what you think in a comment on the website. It's at podcast.thelinuxexp.com or on Mastodon or wherever else you're listening to this. Okay, our second topic is the Fedora 40 beta. It was released this week, coming with GNOME 46 or Plasma 6, and of course you also have all the usual other spins, which will keep to their usual desktop versions because none of them really saw any major improvements. So if you go to Plasma 6, you get a lot more stability, well, compared to 5.27, there are still some bugs in Plasma 6, don't get me wrong, but you do get better Wayland support, you do get improved panels, you get refined settings, and you get a variable refresh rate support, you get HDR, and a bunch of other things. If you go with GNOME 46, you get experimental variable refresh rate support, you get a much better file manager, you also get the ability to log in to a session remotely when using Wayland, instead of just remoting into an already existing session, and you get plenty of improvements to the default apps, you get collapsible and expandable notifications, and a lot more. So the Fedora 40 beta has been delayed a bit before it was released, much like every Fedora release tends to be. The goal is to have the final stable version in mid to late April, although once again, it is not rare for Fedora releases to be pushed back a week or two as they identify bugs that they really want to fix before they ship a new version. This new Fedora 40 version will also get you the Linux kernel 6.8. You will get ROCm6 in the package repos for AMD users that want to do some compute tasks, and you will get updates to virtually every important package and library contained in Fedora's repos. So, depending on the Mesa version that Fedora 40 brings, you might be able to test the new Nuvo and NVK stack if you're an NVIDIA user. So this would be pretty cool. I'm pretty sure Fedora will ship with Mesa 24. Not sure if 24.1 is already out, but probably Mesa 24, which still provides NVK, so you will be able to enable it, and that would be nice. And of course, getting the update to GNOME 46 or to Plasma 6 will be a nice improvement for any Fedora user as well. So it's all good. It should be an interesting release. Maybe I'll cover it in a dedicated video if it does things differently enough compared to just reviewing vanilla Plasma 6 or GNOME 46, which are videos I already did. And with Fedora 40 approaching. Christian Schaller, he's the lead for the Fedora desktop, for desktop at Red Hat in general, and so also for Fedora Workstation. He published an interesting post on what the Fedora team has been working on for this release, but also for GNOME 46, and also what they'll be working on in the future. The first item is about Flatpak, and apparently they're trying to implement a way for applications that require access to system daemons to work properly when packaged as Flatpaks. And this will of course go through systemd, because if I'm not mistaken, Flatpak requires systemd anyway, so you might take advantage of that. And they will also apparently have to build something resembling a permission system to make sure that these apps only have access to the actual daemons that they need, and that they do so in a secure manner. Now, the Fedora team is also working on improving Toolbox. That's the project that lets you run distros inside of containers. It's inherently crucial to stuff like Fedora Silverblue or any of the other immutable variants of Fedora, because your system cannot really be tweaked on the fly, so you kinda need to have a distro in a container to do your development work, for example. And so they want to add support, well, full support, for the NVIDIA proprietary drivers for anything that's running inside of Toolbox, which is going to be crucial to get access to CUDA, which is absolutely important for anything related to AI development, which apparently the Fedora team wants Fedora to be a good platform for. The Fedora team is also working on Nova, of course, the new open source kernel driver for recent NVIDIA GPUs. I'll talk about that at the end of this show in the gaming section. But there's also some work being done on explicit sync. That's a feature important for NVIDIA drivers, but also important to bring performance improvements for GPU-related tasks in general. And thanks to the Fedora teamwork, Pipewire can now handle video properly. The remote desktop can now work properly on GNOME and Wayland, including the new GNOME 46 feature that lets you remotely log in into a session instead of just remoting into an already logged in session. And they're also working on adding HDR support to Mutter, which is GNOME's compositor. So it's a lot of really cool stuff. And if you look at it, these are really the main sticking points for the Linux desktop today. There's the packaging problem, where every app is packaged in a different format. You don't really know how you get them, how you install them. Do you convert a deb to an RPM? Do you add a PPA? Do you use Flatpak or Flathub? It's complicated for new users. So having more work on Flatpak to be able to handle virtually all graphical apps that, well, everything that is not command line, basically, is good, because it means that this format can be suitable for more apps and has more chance of becoming the default format. Doesn't mean everything else will die, but it means we'll have one default format. So that's one issue being solved. The second one is NVIDIA drivers. They've always been problematic for a lot of people on Linux, and so having them work better with all the tools that people are starting to use, generally working better with the proprietary drivers just improving a lot in the past year or so, and having a new stack with open source NVIDIA drivers is solving the issue as well. And the Wayland transition in itself, it is sort of happening whether we like it or not, and so having most problems fixed with that, including, for example, remote desktop, but also performance problems, is good. So it looks like we're finally, well, there's also the HDR thing and the variable refresh rate thing, which are fixing issues with Wayland as well. So having all of these kinks ironed out of the Linux desktop is great. I think it has never been in as good a place as it is right now, and the future is only looking brighter, so I'm very happy about the place we're in right now. We're still in a transition phase on the Linux desktop, but we are making really solid progress on fixing things that are actually problematic. Instead of reinventing everything, we're just building a new stack that will work well and carry us into the future, and I think it is really cool. Our next topic will be about Ubuntu. Canonical announced that their LTS distros will now receive up to 12 years of support, including Ubuntu 14.04 LTS, which, as you might have guessed, released in 2014, 10 years ago, and shipped with the Unity desktop. This is what Canonical calls legacy support. It is not going to be provided to everyone for free. It is a paid add-on to your Ubuntu Pro subscription. So general users that don't have an Ubuntu Pro subscription still get 5 years of support for LTS distros, which is probably more than enough for general users. If you have an Ubuntu Pro subscription, you can push that to 10 years. This is free for individuals up to 5 computers and probably small businesses as well, and it's a paid service for other entities that need it on more devices. And now people that have that Ubuntu Pro subscription will be able to fork a bit more cash again to push that support window to 12 years. This support is only for Ubuntu's main and universe repo, so not absolutely everything in Ubuntu's repo is covered by that extended support. And of course, these extra 2 years will be a paid service. But if you use 14.04 still on an old server or computer, and you want to keep doing so for 2 more years, or if you generally think that running an OS for 12 years without any feature update to any of its libraries or apps is a good idea, well, now you can do so. Now, personally, I felt that 10 years was already way too long, even for servers. 12 years feels even less interesting to me. I would never run an operating system unchanged, basically, apart from security fixes, for 10 or 12 years. But also, I don't run a lot of servers, and my use cases are just not covered by these time limits. So I am sure people will find some use cases where it is absolutely worth it to get 2 more years, and, well, now you can do so. Now, still on Ubuntu, the next LTS, which will release in a bit less than a month, will fix a problem that has apparently plagued a lot of people on Ubuntu, and this being a pretty small virtual memory mapping limit. A lot of other distributions, including Ubuntu derivatives like PopOS, but also stuff like Fedora or OpenSUSE, and anything based on those, allow a lot of memory map areas per process, basically letting a process map a bunch of your RAM to keep working over long periods of time. But Ubuntu stuck to the older value of 65,536, which is absolutely fine for most use cases, but as games and other programs get more and more demanding, it's not really enough anymore, and this apparently resulted in some games crashing before they even open on Ubuntu, some games crashing or showing degraded performance after a little playtime, like Hogwarts Legacy, Payday 2, Counter-Strike 2, or Star Citizen. So Ubuntu 24.04 will multiply this max number by 16, going up to 1 million and something, which is the same value that Fedora and PopOS use. This should also help with other software. I've seen people reporting issues with using Elasticsearch on servers as well due to this problem, and the general fix that is recommended is to increase this virtual memory mapping limit, because you can do it with like editing a text file and running a command. So I learned about this limitation today, to be honest, and since my distro, which is Tuxedo OS, is Ubuntu-based, I checked and I was also constrained by that limit. I tried raising it to the same number as what Ubuntu will have, and it did fix my problems in Helldivers 2. When I played Helldivers 2 for more than an hour, generally my FPS started to tank about 25 to 30 FPS instead of a smooth, stable 60. And so it looks like this change actually does something. The change should affect all Ubuntu-based distros as well, unless they decide to change that thing and keep to the older, smaller limit. But I don't think there's really any reason not to use a higher limit, unless you absolutely want to restrict memory used by running processes. So maybe it could be interesting to keep a smaller limit for older devices that don't have a lot of RAM. But honestly, I don't think it will make much of a difference if you raise that limit on every Ubuntu derivative. Let me know if you know more about any of this. I would be happy to learn more about this specific topic. Now, we already talked at length about the recent influx of malicious snaps on the Snap Store, notably fake crypto wallets. But it looks like Canonical finally decided to change how things work. Basically, when you try to register a new snap on the store, manual reviews will be required for every new application before it is published on the Snap Store. So the actual workflow will be, instead of you register an email address, you enter it as your Snap account, basically you publish your Snap and it's immediately visible on the Snap Store. Now you use your email address, you enter the name of your Snap and a description, you upload the Snap itself, And then it is reviewed by an actual human who could have guessed it would be useful. And that human will check the information provided, they will contact the developer for more details if they need to, and if everything seems legit, the snap will be published. If it's not legit, then it will not be. Canonical's aim is apparently to review snap packages in 2 business days, which seems really fair, and they also specifically mentioned that if the snap is crypto wallet related, it will be automatically rejected for now. They are taking a stance against those crypto apps, probably because even with a manual review, sometimes you let things through, but you gave users a false sense of security by reviewing the application, and also you might be legally liable for any damages because you actually manually reviewed the snap, so if it does something untoward, then maybe someone could turn against your company. So for now, they will just flat out ban anything crypto-related in the Snap Store. They said they would publish a specific policy for crypto apps and other sensitive snaps, probably everything that is personal data related or just finance related. They will have guidelines for how to publish such an application in the future. So this crypto ban is a temporary thing for now. And it is really good to see Canonical finally reacting to the problem. You do not want your app store to be associated with scammy applications or malicious software, because once users or developers think that your platform is just perceived as unsafe, then they will never publish anything to it because it devalues their applications. And users, in turn, will just not want to use it because it's unsafe for them. So it is much better to make developers wait for a few days, especially if Canonical can stick to 2 business days, than to just accept everything and lose all user and developer trust because it means that your platform is just dead. So yeah, if platforms like iOS or even Android have manual reviews, it's for a reason. Like, you cannot automate everything in there. You need to look at packages you're distributing to your users, especially if you intend at some point to sell stuff on this platform. You just need to have humans reviewing it. It is a huge additional cost if you run a big platform, but it is kind of mandatory. And on that same note, FlatHub is making some moves as well. You already know that they had official verified badges for applications that were published on FlatHub by their original developers. You can see them on the FlatHub website, and you can also now see them inside of GNOME software if you run GNOME 46. It's that little blue tick, much like what Twitter used to have when it meant something, that you can hover over, and it's going to tell you that this app has been published by their official developers. But it looks like they're now trying out unverified badges as well. They're little orange tags that appear under the application's name, and they'll let you know that these apps are not published by their original developers. They can be community efforts, they can be malicious stuff, you don't really know, but all you know is that they are not from their original developers. It seems like it's just a test for now, but honestly, I think it's a great idea, especially seeing as the scam app problem seems to be like a really big problem on the Snap Store. So at least people will know when an application isn't 100% official. For most applications, it won't really matter, but for certain app categories, like for example, anything that might hold or request personal data, for example, a web browser, or anything related to money or finance, for these categories of apps, it is invaluable to know that you're not really downloading the official app, so maybe you should go to the developer's website and download the app from there instead. I'm sure some people will think it devaluates community or third-party packages, but in my opinion, it is sort of necessary. We are moving towards those centralized app repos. Flatpak is gaining traction, and it is something that distro packages should have done since the beginning. If you knew about how Linux distros work and how those repos worked, you knew that these applications were generally not provided by their original developers. But if you didn't really know about Linux, you would not be stupid for assuming that downloading an app from a graphical app store inside of Ubuntu was the official app from the developer and it worked just like on iOS or Android, which it didn't. There was no warning telling you that these applications were not made by the original developers. It is absolutely normal to have that on a centralized platform like FlatHub. It should have been in the distro repos as well. Everything that can inform the user is good practice. So I really hope we'll see these unverified badges stay, because also it might have the additional effect of making developers request and take ownership of their own Flatpak packages. Because now you have a pretty big source of downloads for apps, and your app looks unsafe in there because you're not the one publishing it. So maybe it makes developers pay more attention and start publishing their apps on this platform, which in turn makes the platform grow and more interesting for most users, and it's all a virtuous cycle. Everything will be more coherent and it will feel safer for users. Now, the fact that an app is unofficial and not published by the original developers doesn't mean that it is unsafe, and an app that is published by the original developers isn't necessarily safe. But at least you know that you're downloading the original program. So if you trust the developers, then you trust the application. And if you have an issue with that, you know where to turn your ire or anger or lawsuits towards. And it also looks like FlatHub is picking up some steam. Kodi, for example, the media center, is moving to Flatpak as its main distribution method. The Kodi developers took ownership of the Flatpak package and they have retired the Team Kodi PPA that was available for Ubuntu. It looks like maintaining this PPA was just too much work, and since the Linux world is moving towards universal packages like Flatpak, it just did not make sense to keep investing in maintaining plenty of different packages for plenty of different versions of the same distro. The team acknowledges that there is a lot of work still remaining to make those Flatpak builds as versatile as the PPA, mainly because the PPA lets you install stable or nightly releases of Kodi, whether the Flatpak will just let you download normal builds. You can probably also create a Flatpak remote where you publish your own nightly and unstable builds, but FlatHub, as far as I know, doesn't really have the same channel system as the Snap Store has, where you can pick if you want to install the stable, the edge, the beta, the nightly, the whatever version of a snap. I don't think FlatHub has that. So for Kodi, they will have to put some infrastructure in place. And the source is still available, so if you do not like Flatpaks, you can still compile the program yourself, or you can wait for someone to spin another PPA back up and use that instead. And I mean, I totally understand why Kodi would do that. Why would you care? Why would you maintain four or five different packages and builds of your program for four or five different supported versions of a single distro and repeat that for every single distro, when you could make a single package that works everywhere? And I know Ubuntu doesn't really support Flatpak out of the box, but you can add it and then install Kodi. So if the Flatpak has the same functionality as the original packages, there's really no reason to bother with maintaining a PPA. Brave Browser is also now officially on FlatHub. It's been distributed by the Brave developers themselves. And it's cool to see this package format making progress, whether you like it personally or not. If we have a single default package format that every distro supports, it doesn't mean that normal packages or app images will die out. It just means that new users to Linux have a default setting, which is use the Flatpak. It's there. All the apps are in there. It works well. One-click install. You don't have to bother. If you have a bug, you report it directly to the developers. You don't have to understand anything weird or complicated. It works as you're used to on your smartphone, and it just works, basically. But if you're a more advanced user, you don't like that Flatpak adds additional runtimes or uses too much disk space, you will always have other options to install applications, so it doesn't take away anything from you as a user who doesn't like Flatpak, but it makes accessing Linux infinitely easier and better. So these packages need to progress and seeing more apps get in there and more features being added to FlatHub, the main repo for Flatpak, is always really good. Now let's move on to something privacy related, and it's something I missed last week. You might remember Mozilla Monitor Plus. It was an expensive service that Mozilla launched a few weeks ago that had the purpose of trying to scrub your data from data brokers' websites after it has leaked online, or even if it was collected legally, because in most countries you have a right to ask for that data to be removed. Well, that service is now no longer available already, because apparently the provider Mozilla turned to, called OneRep, had ties to data broker websites that sell your data. The company's CEO apparently runs dozens of such websites himself, and OneRep, the company, is also tied to what they call a people search company, so basically a database of personal data available to be purchased by anyone. So at first, OneRep's CEO denied these ties, then he finally admitted them, but he said there was no cross-sharing of information between these data broker websites and OneRep itself, but Mozilla decided to ditch them and to stop their service for now, saying that the interests and activities of OneRep's CEO just did not align with their values. In the end, it doesn't quite matter because that service was never that useful in the first place. If you manage to get your data removed from websites that acquired that data about you legally, that's cool. But these really were not the websites that malicious people were turning to implement problematic and scammy behaviors. And those data scrubbing services will rarely, if ever, manage to remove your data from websites that sell it or acquired it illegally. And these are the ones you want to fight. So using such a service, it doesn't really have a point, in my opinion. So yeah, it was overpriced as well, if you think about it. So not a big loss, but yeah, next time Mozilla, please try and look more into who you're partnering up with, because this just doesn't look good. Our final topic on the privacy front is the EU again. They are investigating Meta, Apple, and Alphabet because they implemented changes to comply, putting that in air quotes, with the Digital Markets Act. But the EU wants to check if they actually comply or if they use that Digital Markets Act to push more barriers or try to skirt around the regulation. So the exact investigations concern rules in the Play Store and the iOS App Store that would push developers to never publish their apps outside of these platforms. For example, Apple implementing a completely weird fee structure that might make it cost you more money if you distribute your app outside of the App Store, which is completely nonsense. Google doing sort of the same thing. So they're investigating that. For Google specifically, there's an additional issue with self-preferencing, where Google highlights their own products first in their search engine, which is not legal under the Digital Markets Act. And there's also for Apple another issue to see if they make it easy enough to use non-Apple software on their devices, like changing web browsers. Is it easy enough to find where you can change the default browser? But other things like that. And finally, for Meta, it's a more complicated topic. Basically, they said, okay, we need to ask user consent to target them with ads, but instead of just asking for user consent, they implemented a paid service. So if you pay for access to Facebook or Meta, you don't get targeted ads. If you don't pay, then you automatically consent to Meta using your information, your personal data, to target you with ads. And the EU thinks that basically it means that there is no path to refuse the use and the collection of your user data to target you with ads if you don't want to pay, and apparently this also would not be legal. So these investigations will probably take around 12 months, and if the companies are found to not comply properly with the Digital Markets Act, they could face fines of up to 10% of their total worldwide turnover, which could be a lot of money. And if you're thinking to yourself that the EU writes vague laws that are hard to comply with, you should also know that these rules were announced more than a year ago, and all these companies had all the time they wanted to reach out and submit their proposal in advance to see if they would be acceptable. So if these companies fail to comply, it is entirely their own fault. It's not a money grab, it's just implementing regulations, that's it. And those companies are always trying to avoid those. Okay, let's finish this with the gaming news. Our first topic will be about Wayland. You might know about the SDL library. It's used by a lot of games and it's meant to simplify developers' work by giving them abstraction layers to interact with video, with audio, with input devices, with CDs, DVDs, networking, plus to handle a few graphics APIs like OpenGL, Vulkan, and even DirectX 11. This library is used by plenty of free and open source games, like Zero AD, but also commercial titles like Trine or Trine 2, and it supports Android, Windows, macOS, Linux, and iOS. And the SDL developers were exploring ditching Wayland as the default backend for the SDL 3.0 release. The reason behind that was due to missing protocols that could result in worse performance when running on Wayland compared to forcing the X11 protocol, meaning the game would run using X Wayland and would have better performance. But it looks like this discussion had a positive effect in general. Wayland developers acknowledged that the issue existed, and they said they were making progress on the relevant protocols. meaning that by the time SDL 3.0 is out, these issues might be fixed, and if they're not, then SDL developers will still be able to default to X11 and X-Wayland. So it's really cool to see various parts of the community interacting in good faith. They point out a problem, and it is addressed instead of the not-so-unusual infighting and shouting match over who should fix it, if it's really an issue or a feature, if the way proposed to fix the issue is actually the right one, and basically everything devolving into a shouting match without anything ever being fixed. If these protocols are implemented, they will also very likely improve performance for other use cases, not just for games using the SDL. So everything should benefit in the end, and it was a nice enough Wayland-related story to talk about, I think. Now, our second thing is Red Hat. They announced that they were working on a new Rust-based graphics driver for NVIDIA GPUs to replace Nuvo, at least for recent GPUs. It is designed to work only with GPUs that rely on the GSP, or GPU System Processor, meaning that it's mostly for RTX series and maybe the GTX 1080, not even sure. The goal is to use Rust as a language because it would apparently decrease the complexity of the code of the driver. They also say that making Nuvo evolve instead of writing something new would require major reworks, so writing something new isn't necessarily a lot more work. And they're only focusing on recent NVIDIA GPUs because first, it makes their job way easier, and second, Nuvo already handles pre-GSP, pre-RTX GPUs relatively well. This driver will of course be open source, they would like it to be upstreamed to the Linux kernel in the future, but apparently there's a lot more work to be done on the kernel itself to have better Rust support before that happens. An NVK, the Vulkan driver for NVIDIA, would very likely work on top of that driver, meaning that we would get a brand new stack for modern, recent NVIDIA GPUs, and Nuvo would still be around for older GPUs that Nova doesn't support. And I think it's a good thing. Nuvo is pretty old, and while it now supports the GSP firmware in recent kernel versions, I am pretty sure a brand new driver will achieve much better performance without all the baggage and handling of those older architectures of GPUs, because from the GTX series to the RTX series, the entire architecture of the cards has changed a lot, and having a dedicated driver that only targets this is probably a good idea. Okay, and to conclude, we have some relatively bad news for Linux gaming, at least for EA titles and Battlefield 5 players. The game is getting EA anti-cheat in April. This solution is being rolled out to a lot of current and a lot of older EA games. And of course, it has zero support for Linux or the Steam Deck, meaning that these games will just not work on Linux anymore. EA anti-cheat is a kernel-level tool, meaning that it has no real way to run on Linux, and the company never expressed any interest for Linux either. And you might think Battlefield 5 is a really old game, it was released in 2018, but it's apparently still pretty popular, and it is just the latest to get this anti-cheat solution. EA seems to want to rely on this thing more and more. And this is sort of worrying because another EA title is very popular and is called Apex Legends. It currently uses Easy Anti-Cheat and it does support Linux, but it could very well move to EA Anti-Cheat in the future, thus preventing Linux gamers from playing it. And I will never say it enough, anti-cheat solutions suck. They do not actively prevent cheating. Cheating is still going on in most games that have anti-cheat solutions. They just need to catch up every time a new cheat manages to bypass their solution. And anti-cheat really hurt Linux gaming. They're the last barrier we have for being a much better gaming platform than Windows ever was. Let's hope this problem will be solved in the future. And honestly, I've talked about it in the daily news show that I do. I think AI would be like, it would be one of the best use cases for AI tools. Instead of trying to write an anti-cheat solution that tries to detect if you've tampered with the actual code or the program, or if you're running something on top of the program, this is just completely imperfect. Using an AI solution to identify and map player behaviors that you train on your own game would be a much better solution. So instead of trying to write chatbots that replace things that we already know how to do really well to do it in a worse way, maybe we should try and implement AI-related tools for gaming instead and identify problematic player behaviors that could just never happen in a real game and use that to ban or block players. It's probably a much better use of AI than anything else we've seen with it. I just do not like anti-cheat tools. They're super invasive in terms of operating systems if you use Windows, and they just block Linux gaming from being cool. So yeah, just remove those things, implement your stupid AI where it would matter, and let's get on with it. Okay, so this will conclude our episode for this week. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. As always, if you need to learn more about any of these topics, don't hesitate to check out the show notes. I have all the links in there. If you want to support the show to keep it going, because it does take a lot of time to prepare these and write these, don't hesitate to check out all the links in the show notes as well. And if you want to have a daily version of that show, well, you just have to become a Patreon supporter, and you'll get that from Monday to Friday. So thanks for listening, and I guess you'll hear me in the next one next week. Bye!